The title of this talk comes from Freud and his book, Civilization and Its Discontents, where he explored the tension between individual choice and social control and conformity. So this was a very early work on conflict. And like any responsible Silicon Valley resident, I looked up conflict on Google, and I found the root of the word comes from the Latin com, meaning together, and fligere, meaning to strike. Together they form the Latin word confligere, which means to strike together or to clash. And this creates fire. So I dressed appropriately. So I'd like you all to think for a moment about your own definition of conflict. I'll give you about 10 seconds to just think, what are the important components in your mind that makes something a conflict? So how many of you thought disagreement? By a raised show of hands. And how many of you thought opposition? And did anybody have competition in there? That's because we're all you use. Well, interestingly, none of those things are actually conflict, even though a lot of definitions include those words. So I'm going to share a definition by one of my colleagues, Julia T. Wood, in her interpersonal book. Her definition is, interpersonal conflict can be overt or covert and exists when people who depend on each other express different views, interests, values, or goals, and perceive their views as incompatible or oppositional. So she also uses those words. But in the research and work that I've done and the classes I've been teaching for the last 15 years, that a key aspect of conflict is the sense or perception of threat. So what shifts something from a disagreement or opposition is fear and a lack of a sense of safety. Because people who feel comfortable and safe, they love to argue and they don't see it as a conflict. And people who are in opposition, like teams that are playing against one another, they're not necessarily in a conflict because when it's over, they're friends, hopefully, and shake hands and it's over. So this is an important part of conflict, is that experience of threat. And there's three different types of conflict. One is situation-based, which is when, like road rage, when you're off the road and finished, you may have some adrenaline, but then it fades and the conflict is over. It's very specific to that experience. And then the second is resource-based, which Ed talked about in his reflection. There's a sense of scarcity. Two units, they each wanted the one with the better view. And the last one is identity-based conflict, where our very sense of self is under threat. And people who think disagreement is a conflict, it creates a lot of anxiety because you think, oh, if this person is disagreeing with me, then something about me must be wrong or something is wrong with them and therefore I'm not safe. So this is why the land acknowledgement was really important to me to have that today, because yes, land is a resource, but it's also such a significant and profound part of Native people's sense of identity. And by taking their land, it's like you stole their soul. So I think it's always important to remember that yes, we didn't steal the land personally, but we are of that legacy. So to keep that in mind, and also the Middle East, you know, who owns what land, you know, Jerusalem, it's the heart of that conflict in the Middle East. So it's a significant thing to keep in mind. And then I just want to say that I did really want to do a PowerPoint today. Because, you know, I'm a teacher and I'm like, okay, follow along. But I resisted, but I do realize this may sound a little bit like a lecture. I'm hoping it's helpful to you though. So I'm just sharing the things that my students have found helpful. So this next one are what I've called the levels of conflict, and I've borrowed these concepts from persuasion. And the first one is the level of fact. So for example, you shared my mother's secret recipe. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Or you just hit me. No, I didn't. I just got finished teaching first graders for the last month, and so there was a lot of that. He cut in line. No, I didn't. Yes, he did. So there's a lot of this kind of conflict with little first graders. And we all do it too. Yes, I did. No, I didn't. And then the next level is the level of importance, that this matters or it doesn't matter. So if you say you shared my mother's secret recipe and the other person says it's not that big of a deal, it's not that important, that's a different level of conflict. It's still hurtful and hard. Or it wasn't my fault, also a very common first grader response. And then the last level is action. What should we do about this? So both parties agree that yes, the incident occurred, it was significant, what should we do about it? So then we try to figure out, you know, you can ask for the recipe back, you could ask your friend not to pass it on. But if one person is arguing at the fact level and the other person is arguing at the what should we do about it level, you're never going to resolve the conflict because you're at two completely different levels of the issue. So it's always good to diagnose what is actually going on, which is why conversation is really helpful. So these are common responses to conflict. I didn't mean to hurt you. This is a very common thing people say. But I do want to point out that only 1 to 3% of the population are sociopaths who intend harm. So it's this particular explanation rarely helps people feel better. And we somehow think that if we did not intend harm, then we're not responsible for it. Which in a way, you know, sometimes people read into things, they perceive that you meant something that you didn't actually mean. So intention does matter, and it's important to talk that through and be, if you're the offended person, to be willing to listen to what's going on with the other individual. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. Another common response is, well, this is what actually happened. So that rarely goes over well because you're correcting the person and it can seem very invalidating. But the person who is the offender thinks, I'm just being misunderstood. And therefore, if you see things the same way that I see things, then you won't feel bad. So again, the intention is a good one, but it very rarely helps. Another common response is explaining one's reasoning. So, you know, why you did something, what the background information of it is, it sometimes becomes a little mini monologue, and that is not really helpful for the person who's feeling upset. You're actually doing the opposite of what the offended party needs, which is to get it out and talk about it. Because it takes a lot of guts to bring up a conflict. It takes a great deal of courage, so it's good to remember that. And then lastly, and most unsavory one, is blaming the other party. That if you had just explained your preferences better, we wouldn't be in this mess, right? So just shirking all responsibility. And we all do these things. I mean, we get defensive when we feel that somebody is blaming us for something. So a little more of things that affect our framing or perception of a conflict is, I borrow this from the world of psychology, it's attribution theory, and this is just a small part of that theory, but it's explaining the motivation of another person's behavior. So there's the internal attribution, which is just somebody's makeup, who they are, that they're behaving this way just because that's just what they do. And then external, which is circumstantial, or the events surrounding that person. So an internal attribution about the recipe situation. You shared this special recipe because you're not responsible and now I cannot trust you. Now it becomes an identity-based conflict and it's a much deeper conflict than just a resource-based conflict. And then the person might respond, I shared it because so-and-so really pushed me to share it. I had something special and she wanted it, and she's so forceful, I just couldn't help it. So focusing on something outside of oneself for the behavior. So it's good to keep these in mind and give people the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes people really just weren't thinking, and to say, okay, I realize you're under a lot of stress, you haven't had a lot of sleep, you know, just give people the benefit of the doubt. And if it becomes a pattern though, that becomes a different conversation. If somebody keeps doing something over and over again, even though you've already talked to them about it, then you need to have a different kind of conversation. So then you think, well, what do I do? So I can tell, okay, we're back. All right, good. That was good timing, actually, because I'm about to talk about listening. So we planned that. No, we didn't. So there's five types of listening. The first one is listening for appreciation, just enjoying the sound of maybe the rain, the waves. Going to a live concert is so nice to see live music. We tend to prefer that over recorded music. The second kind of listening is comprehension. And this is generally what we think of as listening, that you speak and I understand what you're saying and then we go on from there. And sometimes that can get messed up. So for example, I was an occupational therapist for a long time, and one of my colleagues once had a patient who had very poor balance, but he had used the restroom, and so she, you know, stood outside the door to honor his privacy, and then she opened the door a little crack and said, you know, Mr. So-and-so, are you finished? And he shouted back, no, no, I'm Danish. So, okay, a little misunderstanding. He didn't understand, but she knew he was okay that he answered, so the job was done. And we just called him Mr. Danish after that. And then there's listening for discrimination, where you're listening for a very particular thing. So maybe it's directions. It might be whether you agree or disagree with this person. Maybe you're defensive because you already feel guilty about something, so you're listening to see if this person is upset with you. So this very specific kind of, also known as selective listening, is common in relationships. The next type of listening is evaluative, where you're somewhat critical, and this can be very important if you're making a big purchase, maybe you're buying a car, you need to really evaluate the pros and cons. What is the source of this person's material? So it can be a very useful, all these different types of listening can be very useful and not useful depending on the situation. And then the last type is empathy. And if somebody's just had a hard day, they may just want some kind of support. And as you might have guessed, if you mix the last two up, that can create conflict. So if you say, oh, I just had the worst time with my boss again today, and you as the partner say, well, here's a 10-point plan of what you can do to address this issue with your boss. And you know, sometimes people just need to vent. So one of my mottos in my class is it's best to not meet emotion with logic. It tends to not go well with people. So I'd like to talk just briefly as well about the book Getting to Yes. This was a book written many years ago, 1991, by authors Roger Fisher, William Urey, and Bruce Patton. And they talked about the difference between positions and interests. So I'm gonna go back to the example of the recipe. You know, you shared my mother's secret recipe and I'm upset about it. That's a position, that's what the person did. But why you're upset about it is what really matters. So if the person is astute enough as a listener to say, why is that so upsetting to you? Say, because it was a special bond. I was the only person that my mom shared that recipe with. And now there's been an invasion in that special bond, and so I feel really deeply hurt. Then the person can respond a little more accurately to what's actually going on with you. So another example, if somebody says, hey, do you want to go see the art display at the De Young Museum? They might be interested in the art, or they just may want to spend time with you. So if you're not interested, instead of just saying no, you could say, well, I'm not sure I want to see the art, but I really like the idea of going to the city with you. How about going to the Bluegrass Festival at the Golden Gate Park instead? And then you can find out more what is the deeper aspect of what's going on with that person. So those of you who have been here for a long time, Amy has shared with us that it's good to speak from your scars, not your wounds, especially when you're, you know, sharing a sermon or sharing a story, sharing something that can make you vulnerable. Because if your audience is worried about you, then that you break the connection a little bit. So what's tricky in conflict is that people are speaking from their wounds. Because it's a sense of threat and a sense of fear, people don't feel safe. So it's important to keep in mind people are coming from their wounds, not their scars, when there's conflict. And people have different levels of emotions when they're experiencing conflict. So for example, in a nod to Reverend Peter, he jokes that people from Minnesota don't show a lot of emotion. But I do want to say that I knew a man from Minnesota who loved his wife so much he almost told her. But seriously, different cultures and personality types show different levels of emotion. So it's good to keep that in mind. If somebody's reaction isn't as strong as you would like, or it's too strong, that it just varies. And a key thing to keep in mind is your tone of voice. So there's a really big difference between "are you ready?" and "are you ready?" Right? It's the tone that carries that second level of meaning. So it's good to be the thermostat, not just the thermometer, that you set the temperature, not just feel what the temperature is. So here's some basic tips. How do you address and repair breaches? If you're the offended party, be clear with yourself first what you hope to accomplish. What do you want or need from the other party? And it's useful to prepare a script before the conversation, even if it's just in your head. Conflict makes people feel very vulnerable. It's why most of us avoid it. But it's really important to have a conversation about it, especially if the other party is important to you. So you can describe the behavior or event in as neutral of terms as possible. Share how it made you feel. Share the consequences you're experiencing because of the breach. And make a request, not a demand, of the other party. And then after you're clear in your own head, then make time to bring it up with the other person. Because overt conflict is so much easier to deal with than covert conflict. Because you can feel it when something is off with another person, and if they don't say it out loud, it's hard to know how to navigate that. Starting line could be, "I've experienced a breach in our connection. Would you be willing to talk with me about it so we can repair it?" So this is a line I used with a friend, and we had a conflict, and she was willing to talk about it, and it was uncomfortable. You just have to get ready to be uncomfortable during the conversation. But then we fixed it and completely resolved it. It's useful to state clearly that you value the relationship with the other person. That helps them feel safe. It can help calm things between you. And be clear to stick to your own perceptions versus making inferences about the other person's intentions. So for example, "I noticed you did not call me yesterday at our agreed upon time." That's just a statement of what you observed. Instead of saying, "I feel bad that you did not want to talk with me yesterday." So when you make an inference, now you have two conflicts, because the person didn't call you and you have to address that. And then that other person has to say, "No, it's not that I didn't want to talk to you." So then they have to address that second level. So to be as observant as possible is helpful. And the person who offended, do your best to listen to comprehend rather than to fix the situation or correct the perception. That's really hard to do, especially if you feel wrongly perceived. Be fully present. Don't multitask. Don't be on your phone. Because when you're on your phone, you're sending the message to the other person, "I'm not really interested in what you're saying." And that can be very difficult for another person. And again, remember the courage that it takes for the other person to bring the conflict out into the open. And if you're present to help, that will help repair it. So a little bit of a review, because you know I'm a teacher, that's what we do. So know what you want and need from the other person. That's really important. And one of the most unproductive things you can do is to meet emotion with logic. You cannot resolve conflict unless you tell the truth. And you cannot resolve conflict if you are judging the other party. So try, a colleague of mine just shared this with me, pace, space, grace. That first you may need to slow down, because usually we speed up and want to get it all out. Both parties. Little slowing down, give a little space to the other person, let them respond once you've said what you need to say, which is hard when you're the offended because you just want to keep going, but you need to create space for the other person to respond. And then offer grace, because people are different from us. They perceive things differently than we do. So the potential benefits of conflict is it can clear the air, like a heavy rainstorm. It can clarify relationships and roles. It can generate new ideas. And it can relieve tension and make future conversations more likely. So we always need to navigate the tension between individual and group needs. People are different. It's our job to learn who they are. And then hopefully the fire we encounter will simply keep us warm.